Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David. Since the pandemic hit and made touring and performing impossible, I've taken to broadcasting interviews with people who I can't visit in person anymore. They're live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. All these interviews also then go up in podcast form afterwards, which you can find if you look up This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovics.com. Today, we're spending the hour with writer, organizer, filmmaker, Andres Thomas Canteras. Andres is a dissident from a family of dissidents. He's lived in many different parts of the U.S. and elsewhere in the Americas, spending a significant chunk of his life exposing the war crimes of the U.S. and its client states. He has led many international delegations, and he's been arrested many times while interrupting congressional hearings of war criminals such as John Negroponte. He co-produced a film about the School of the Americas, the School of the Assassins, and U.S. foreign policy called Hidden in Plain Sight. He was instrumental in spreading the daily news and information show Democracy Now! Across the Spanish-speaking world. Andres, welcome to my little live stream show. Andres, what are you doing in Guatemala? Can you tell us? You ended up, you're always somewhere else every time I look you up, and you're never wherever you were last time I knew you were there. You're not there anymore, but now you're in Guatemala. And what's happening? What's the situation like there? How's the pandemic? What's going on?
Well, first of all, David, thank you for having me on your excellent show. I've really enjoyed some of the podcasts, reconnecting with some of my friends who you've interviewed over the years. So
we have a lot of mutual friends, so I'm sure you know half of my guests.
It's been great. So, I want to enter this interview in the spirit of the place where I am by honoring the Mayan people who have been in these lands for millennia. Right where I am here is in San Lucas Toliman. It is part of one of the many Mayan communities around Lake Atitlan, in Guatemala, and it's important to enter this time with you in connecting with their spirit, I think, because we are here only because of so much blood that's been shed by indigenous peoples over the centuries and millennia, and their memory needs to be honored at any point that we can make that possible. So I'm glad to be able to do that here. And also to remember where you are there in Oregon. My very first experience with a sweat lodge ceremony was with the Klamath people, the indigenous people there in Oregon. And so I also want to raise their name here as you and I have our conversation.
Yeah, good. You know, I was looking for, I was trying to find a map of all 500 Indian nations in the present day the United States. Mm-hmm. I can't find one anywhere. I mean, if you ever come across one, you know, because mm-hmm. like in Australia, it's very common, and as it should be, that anytime there's any event anywhere that ever happens, you know, unless it's white supremacists, they're going to talk about the people whose land they are, whose unceded stolen land they are on. But if you want to do that in the United States, you got to do a lot of research, because like, unless you already know a lot of stuff about history, you know, which is at this point fairly obscure history, you know, trying to figure out what land, whose stolen land you're actually even on is quite a challenge. I mean, the Klamath people, as far as I know, we're talking about Southern Oregon, and the Modoc people as well. And yeah, mm-hmm. it's, yeah. But, and of course, it's so, I mean, if anybody thinks this is a matter of history, obviously, I think among anybody watching this show, that's probably not very many. But at the border, at the U.S.-Mexico border, so many of the people that are being separated from their parents or separated from their children or otherwise detained or turned away don't even speak Spanish.
That's exactly right. And so the layers and layers of how racism continues to be perpetrated. And the extinction practice of colonization, which decimated and committed complete genocide against so many indigenous peoples in the United States area, in all of North America, and throughout the Americas, is continuing today. I mean, it's really what you just described is one example of the forced separation of children, and you know, just the incredible, incredible way that the virus is basically committing capital punishment against the brown and black people that Trump so very much wants to get rid of anyway, you know? So the way that these policies have taken a been put into practice over the centuries just takes on a new flavor, but the suffering and the decimation and the genocide is the same.
In the area you're on there in the lake, do you hear a lot of Mayan languages spoken? Is it Quetzal is commonly spoken? Or?
Well, there are a number of Mayan languages. The one mm-hmm. here in San Lucas Toliman is Cachiquel. The one next door in Santiago Atitlan is the Tzutukil. There's Mam, there's Chorti, there's lots of other languages. Just like in the U.S., there are so many languages that have become extinct because over the centuries it's not practiced anymore. I was in South Dakota a few years ago, and there's an effort there, both in prisons and elsewhere, to get the Lakota language to be actively taught to future generations. And that's something that needs to happen in so many other indigenous languages all across our hemisphere.
It's really, I mean, from my experience with sort of dying languages, they usually are not revived. And I mean, you know, and one of the rare examples that goes in the other direction is Welsh, but all the efforts for all the, you know, for all the resources that a relatively wealthy country like Ireland has, they have been totally, they've completely failed at reviving the Irish language. But but Welsh, it's a different story for some reason. I mean,
good to celebrate those, you know, exceptional instances and hope that they can be replicated. So
one of my most fond touring memories before the age of satellite radio, you know, and all internet and everything else, was you tune into the local radio, and in large swathes of present day South Dakota, the only radio station you get is in the Lakota language, and I've spent a long time listening to some old man. I don't have any idea what he was talking about, but in between his every now and every half an hour or so, he'd break into English and he'd say, "You don't understand your language? I'm speaking your language. Learn your language." And then he'd go back into Lakota. It was really excellent. But what is the situation with the pandemic in Guatemala like? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the places that, at least among the many places we do hear about a lot, like the places that are doing really well or the places that are doing really badly. Guatemala, we're not hearing all that much about up here, and I'm guessing it's because it's somewhere in between a total disaster and not. Or
it is near. I mean, near total disaster. It's, you know, I just heard this morning that all of Latin America is only 8% of the world's population, and yet has 30% of the COVID positive cases around the world. So that's that. Guatemala pretty much is part of that statistic. It's not as bad, of course, as Brazil or Mexico even, but. And luckily, right here where I am, there hasn't been a big outbreak around Lake Atitlan. The capital is where most of the infections are, which is a big urban center, of course. But something happened here in this town, San Lucas Toliman, recently, just in the last 2 weeks. The president came out on a Sunday evening, and basically then a report was broadcast after he spoke. And in it, this village, among the 17 villages in the whole department, which is the equivalent of a state, was the only one listed as a red zone. And it turned out to be declared that way because they had basically tested five people, three of whom came out positive. And that means more than 50%. And therefore, they declared the entire village as a red zone, which really put people up in arms and literally actually did put them up in flames, because they ended up going to the municipality that night and burning it down. It's a historic patrimony of the country, over 100 years old, and it's now, you know, in ashes.
The whole town, the town center, was burned down.
Just the mayoral,
like the city hall, kind of.
The city hall was basically burned. Yes, and it just happened 2 weeks ago. I live two blocks from there, you know, and it happened that night. And basically, it's totally related to the ineptitude of the leadership of the town, because they don't communicate with the village at all. But second, it's also the pathetic way in which the statistics are calculated, because you can't test five people, determine that more than 50% of them have a positive case, and then basically give a sentence to the whole village. Because, you know, there's already the hunger and poverty, which is becoming more acute as a result of the pandemic, is a very serious problem. And so to be declared a red zone was a slap in the face when it's really not true. And that's why the people responded that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's having such different impacts in different parts of the world for so many different reasons. But one of the, as a very international minded person, Andres, I know you're aware that Cuba is doing really well with keeping the pandemic at bay. And then the situation varies so much in so many different parts of the world. But have you been in touch with anybody in Cuba? Are you getting any news from parts of the world that are doing well?
Yes. I'm in touch with a friend who worked in Cuba a great deal. She's back in California right now, but she's in close touch. And I'm glad you mentioned Cuba, because and I want to put a shout out to an international campaign to declare the Cuban medical brigades as being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So there's a big effort to try to do that. And that would be very, very well deserved. So hopefully those who are listening to this podcast can also join in and sign on to that campaign. So Cuba is one example. I have a friend who's been following the situation in New Zealand, which pretty much eliminated it for 100 days, but then very recently they've gotten some cases that have come up and have gone into lockdown again, as I understand. But what's very clear is that what's happening in the U.S. is that there's not a priority to respond to the healthcare of the population, because most of the people are not the upper 1%. They're not the billionaires. They're not the utterly wealthy. It's true that some wealthy have been hit by the virus, but that's a very small percentage compared to the vast numbers of Latino and African-American and indigenous people. The people of color are the ones who are mostly suffering in the U.S. And therefore, because that's the case, there's not a priority to really get rid of it.
It's really quite something, that the way it's exposing those societies that actually have a public health sector and those that don't. But here in the U.S., it seems like at the same time as the government is failing to look after the population, there's also the concern for mass social upheaval, though. I mean, I think the powers that be are worried about that as well, which is why they at least for a time expanded unemployment money, which has now run out. And by some freak coincidence, there's also been a lot of rioting in Chicago just after the money ran out. So I don't know, might not be unrelated.
Completely unrelated. Why would it be unrelated? Why would there be any relation at all? I mean, and it just points to the reality of the power system in the empire of the United States that is the most wealthy country per se in the world. However, it doesn't have a health system for its people. And any attempt to do that has been quashed. And even if the Democrats come to power, there's no commitment to have Medicare for all. So it's just ridiculous that the wealthy in the country, in the oligarchy, can get away with having over 100,000 people killed by a virus that that could have been put under control under what China did, under what Hong Kong, what New Zealand, what other countries have done, which is shown to be able to effectively fight it. It has not been done. And that's why Brazil, which is where another dictator who doesn't care about his people, is the second highest in the world in terms of where the virus is causing so much death. And, you know, he would be proud of going out without a mask, and then he finally got infected himself. So it's incredible how also the virus is kind of a voice for Mother Earth herself, you know, pointing out these incredible discrepancies of these dictators like Trump and Bolsonaro, but also slowing down capitalism particularly enough on the planet so that the Earth can breathe again. You know, it's amazing these images that have come where the pollution has just gone down immensely. And so in that sense, there's a silver lining to all of this too.
It's a fascinating situation that the government that has the most in common with the U.S., the leader with the most in common with Trump, the neoliberal regime that has most to do with the U.S. is the one that's doing so badly. And then the country that's most targeted by the U.S. and most vilified in the Americas is the one doing the best. It's an age of, I think actually the last time I saw you, I was reading a book called Fantasyland, and it's just about the history of the U.S. as a, from the perspective of a big sort of a confidence man, con man kind of history of the U.S. It's like, because there's always fantasies being sold in this country from the beginning, from before the beginning of the country, right? It's sold as a fantasy. The new man is going to be the American. We're being sold by the European settlers originally as the new human, like a new form of human somehow or other. I mean, and it's always been this kind of like most Protestant religions that have come about in the history since the U.S. has been a country have come out of the United States. You know, I mean, there's always new forms of fantasy being sold, which in whether it's religion or politics or, but now the fantasy just doesn't work anymore. Like the fantasy doesn't prevent pandemics. Exponential That's right. spread of a pandemic doesn't care about fantasies.
Exactly. And, you know, who is selected to be the head of the U.S. empire but the prevaricator in chief? For Trump, there is no truth other than the fact that he declares it, really. And he ends up believing it. And that in itself has been, you know, he's gotten away with it primarily, and it's amazing how he's pulling down the Republican Party, and in that sense, he's a blessing. But the fact that he's not able to even hold truth independently in his own mind is very indicative of the empire itself and why it's crumbling. Because, I mean, I'm working on a writing project, and the whole issue of truth is very central, and in fact, that becomes one of the key elements, if not the key, as to why empires fall, really, because it's that power corrupts so much that the truth is made up by those in power, and therefore they have no semblance of context of what's really happening, and therefore it has to crumble. So. You know, we're seeing that in play right now in Washington, and we're also seeing in play, David. I mean, I remember in one of your interviews, I think it was with David Solnit or something, you asked if there is going to be an election coming up in November, right?
Yeah. And what do you think? You heard about what just happened with the post office, right? Now they fired the entire, all the leaders of the post office, and they're taking away machines, sorting machines from postal sorting place. I mean, it's just so crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. You're pointing to the Friday night massacre that happened just Friday of all of the executives, right under the guy that Trump just named as the Postmaster General, have been fired. And so, yes, that is yet one of the many strategies in order for the election to be tampered with. But here's the deal, David, it's important for folks to know that Trump came to power by not getting a popular election, right? And most people think that you need an election majority in the Electoral College also to get to power, which is actually something that most of us believe, because in history, that's exactly what's mostly happened all the time. Not all the time, but most of the time. So that's what we always think will happen, is that even if they don't win the popular vote, if they win at the Electoral College level, they'll become president. That's not the case necessarily. And this is so vital. And you as a historian, you know, need to know it as well. It's possible for Trump to disrupt and to claim that there's no final result in some of the swing states come November. Therefore, those votes in the Electoral College will not count. And then if there's no majority in the Electoral College, even though he clearly in a normal situation would have lost very likely in the Electoral College, but if he's able to disrupt enough and prevent those votes to be counted in the Electoral College, you know where it goes? It goes to the House of Representatives. But this is what's really important there. It doesn't go to the House in a normal vote that the Democrats control. It goes to the House of Representatives, one state, one vote. And there, the Republicans have the control. The state of Wyoming, which is 1/100th the population of the state of California or so, has the same voting power as California. It's crazy. And there are more Republicans in power, and another more states in power in the Republican hands in the House of Representatives, and they will have more votes for their candidate for president. And that's how legally Trump can be elected without winning either the popular or the Electoral College vote.
Right. There was, I can't remember if it was on Democracy Now! Or BBC or somewhere, I was hearing an interview with someone who had done an organization that had done a sort of a war games scenario, kind of playing out the different ways that things could go if Trump wanted to steal the election. And their conclusion was like, well, there's all kinds of different ways he could steal the election.
Exactly. Yeah. Which just goes to show that, you know, if elections could really bring change, they would be illegal, really, you know? And it's not to say that there aren't exceptions, because, you know, it's great that Ilhan Omar basically beat out the billionaires who tried to oust her in a primary election. And she's going to be one of the true voices for justice and common sense in the House. And, you know, I think I have a lot of respect for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as well. I mean, there are some exceptions of those who have chosen to try to get power in the system, who are really having an influence. However, if they really got to power, they wouldn't be permitted. It's very clear.
And also, of course, they never have a majority of any kind of control over their parties, right? I think there was the recent military budget, the biggest in the world, in the history of the world, once again, bigger than last year, which was the biggest in the history of the world. This was, there were 100 Congress people, I believe, who voted against it, which, as somebody put it, that Ben Minsky said, that means the war party, there's 100 people in Congress who are not part of the war party.
Right. Exactly. You know what I call them? I call them the Republic rats. Okay. So why are they the Republic rats? Well, if you say that word, if you say those two words fast, you'll come up with it. Basically, they are the Republicratic Party. You know, it's one party. It's one war. It's one military industrial complex party. And anyone that really would threaten that power structure would not be permitted to have power. So that's why elections really ultimately systemically will not bring change, and we have to look for change to come otherwise.
And the influence of extra parliamentary movements can be quite impressive, even on politicians that are basically totally corrupt, like most of our leaders in this country. Like, I'm thinking of the uprising following the murder of George Floyd, and the fact that there were outside agitators somehow simultaneously rioting and looting every city in the country at the same time, which is quite an impressive thing that you can have that many outside agitators all at the same time. But that seems to have had quite an influence on the government. And it seems much more than any kind of letter writing campaign could possibly have. And I think it's kind of obvious if you're paying attention. And then, so every time I get like some kind of email from some organization saying, write your congressman. And like, I'm always thinking, like, have you been paying attention to what's been going on over the past few months? Do you not realize that it was actually smashing up the banks and that actually got the attention of the government for the first time in so long? And I think of France with the yellow vests. It's the same kind of thing. The labor movement shuts down the country every year, but the yellow vests have gotten more out of Macron than in a very long time, as far as people analysis there goes.
This has been
sort of part of your in terms of your life activities, which have often involved breaking various laws. You've also come to this conclusion that this is a more effective way of trying to get stuff done. I mean, how many times have you been arrested? Do you know?
I don't know.
You ever keep track at the middle of the night? Do you ever think let me try to count?
I don't know, 30 or more times probably. But there are that's not even saying much compared to those who are in the Plowshares movement, who go to jail for years on end, you know, taking on the military nuclear madness as just, willing to put their lives on the line and go to jail for sometimes multiple years. That's something I've never, dared to do, but we all do our own part. It's like you say, I mean, if someone shifts from writing their letter to their congressperson to actually going out in the street, that's an escalation that is called for. That is exactly what we need. Each of us may not be ready to get arrested dozens of times, but we may, stop paying war taxes, or we will be out in the streets with Black Lives Matter, or, there are always ways that we can increase our commitment to bring the change that's needed, that's threatening the life support system on the planet itself. And so that means that if we don't do it, we're on a collective suicide mission, basically. And in a sense, you asked, why is it that I'm here in Guatemala? I'm working on a writing project that's actually part novel. So it has fiction to it, but also if the reader is interested in how a certain story comes up, for instance, the naming of the country of Honduras, one of the myths says that it came from the diary of Christopher Columbus after a big storm. And the word Honduras means basically the depths. So that's one of the stories I tell in the fictional account, but then I have a very strong connection to Honduras. And you mentioned John Negroponte. He was the U.S. ambassador under Reagan to Honduras and brought death squad democracy to the country in the early 80s. And then later on, he became the UN ambassador under George Bush Jr. right after 9/11, and then the ambassador to Iraq during the war there, and then the first DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. Anyway, I decided that I had to be present in each one of those Senate confirmation hearings to speak truth to power because of what I had known he had done in Honduras in the early 80s, where I lived in Honduras for 5 years. And so so in the work that I'm moving forward with is there's the novel, which is the fiction, but then there will be links, and in the written form, I guess there'll be extended footnotes of, well, how is it that the author is related to Honduras? And so then I can talk about being a close friend of Berta Cáceres, who was assassinated as an environmental indigenous woman in 2006. And she and I worked very closely in the 1990s. She and her husband named me on a commission of guarantors to guarantee an accord that was signed between the Honduran government and the indigenous leaders in Honduras. That took place in 1997. So anyway, those are stories that I can tell if the reader is interested. Otherwise, they can just stay in the fictional account.
It's sort of two books you're writing at the same time.
Yes. And actually, it's even growing from there, because eventually it might evolve where it's not just a personal memoir, but a collective memoir that we can all contribute to if folks are interested. And it really, when I was born, my family lived in the middle of Wisconsin, and my mother's family's from Uruguay, South America, but we were living in Wisconsin at the time with the Oneida indigenous people. Mm-hmm. And at that time, our family was invited to a ritual where each of us was given a name, and I was told that my name was Shooting Star. And that is something I forgot years later, but then came back to it. And it really made the connection for me between that which is cosmological, that which has to do with the wisdom of the universe, and what I had been living in my family and in my personal life in terms of my uncle being a political prisoner under the military dictatorship in Uruguay for 8 years. And then the very year that he's freed in 1985, his only son, my cousin, was a Uruguayan volunteer with the coffee brigades. And he ended up being killed by the Reagan-sponsored terrorists there in Nicaragua. You know, so those things really affected my life. And that's why you ask how many times I'm arrested, and I don't even know, but that's been my way of being in the trenches and living, trying to live up to the song that you sing, you know, After the Revolution, which is a beautiful song that I recommend to everybody. But for me, it's important because of this name that I was told that I was given as a child, which is related to cosmological wisdom. My passion now involves using wisdom that we can gain from the universe itself in order to look at the incredible crises and the apocalypse that we're facing on planet Earth right now. And so the writing that I'm doing really makes that connection in terms of cosmic wisdom and revolutionary change.
That's wonderful. And you've been at this project a very long time. It's going to be quite something, I think, when you did you see the shooting start last night? Did you know last night, apparently from 2 a.m. until, I don't know, dawn or something, there's supposed to be a really impressive meteor shower.
Yes. It's the Perseid meteor shower. And it is, I didn't see it last night, but it's also on tonight. I encourage folks to go out and see it as well. But yes. That connection, connecting to the cosmos and the miracles that happened there, is a way also for us to engage in our more creative imaginal, right? So you've had folks on who really speak about the need for, you know, to work with culture and art in terms of resisting the dominant paradigm, which I completely agree with. And what I'm trying to do is carry that to a level of realizing that the cosmos itself can give us some insight into what's happening in terms of what is needed on the planet and all of the crises that we're facing. So it's kind of exciting to move forward with this. And yeah.
And where are you at in the process? Would you say the process of working on this? I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing that could never be. It's almost like the internet, like how many links you could possibly put in. But at some point, you're going to decide it's done, I assume.
You're right. It does have at least an ending of what could end up being, you know, a trilogy or something. But it does. Yes, I have written a good percentage of it. However, I have really got to put my the rubber has to hit the road, basically, because I'm working with some lunar rhythms in particular that are pointing to how revolution has happened on the planet. And it's really fascinating to see this. And basically you can't ask for an extension to the moon herself, basically. So that's what I've discovered. And so there's no more putting it off. So I'm hoping to have something out by the end of the year.
So the rant that this, I want to know how the moon might have affected a revolutionist historically, but I just want to mention that one of the really obscure things I learned in my travels that had an impact on, I mean, the kinds of things that can have an impact, you never know, right? And there was normally the herring run in Scandinavia goes from Denmark across the Sound south of Sweden. But in 1814, I believe, it went inexplicably in a different direction up the coast of Norway instead, which increased increased the protein consumption of the oppressed and hungry Norwegians to such an extent that they basically chose that year to rebel against Swedish rule because they had enough energy to do it. You know, I don't know, you know, if that's at all related to how the moon is related to revolution. I thought I'd mention the herring run.
Yes. Well, you know, in a sense, the answer is yes, because it's those connections that are sometimes mystical that don't really bring comprehension to our rational mind that really make a difference. And you're giving a tremendous example. I want to make very clear that when you say how can the moon cause that, it's very important to know that the moon itself doesn't cause anything like that, but it can be used as a pointer. And this is part of the fictional account, so people can take it or leave it. It doesn't matter, but it's fascinating in terms of some patterns that I've discovered. And before I jump into that, I want to say that even the word revolution is so important to look at, because I mean, you know, do you know anything about the etymology, or how is it that that word took on a revolutionary significance? Do you have any clue about that?
No, but it is interesting how it means multiple things. There's sort of the turning, of course, and as well as the overturning.
Yes, overturning is one of the dimensions, true. But for millennia, really, the word revolution just meant to revolve. It just meant to go around. But when did it become revolutionary? It happened around the time of Copernicus, when he said in his treatise that it's not that the earth is the center and the sun goes around the earth. It's that the earth revolves around the sun. That was so revolutionary and so unacceptable to that society and that church and that power structure in government. They couldn't take it. You know, he had to be quiet about it, but finally it became accepted that that we are not a terracentric solar system. It is heliocentric with the sun. And so, but it's so precious that the revolutionary aspect of the term is originating from a cosmic relationship, which I think is beautiful, because that's exactly a central theme to what I'm writing about, right? So in terms of the lunar rhythms, I want to honor those who really have a lot of respect for astrology, because I think there's a lot of wisdom there. I don't know that much about astrology, but I have a lot of respect, especially this year in 2020, when so many predictions around planetary alignments would really bring a lot of upheaval, and it's exactly what we're seeing. And there are academics like Professor Richard Tarnas who dedicate their entire professional career to these kind of mysteries. So, but that's not where I'm going with my writing. I'm making a connection between something that is very much astronomical, that is, that the hardcore scientists look at very clearly. And with the moon, one example is the total lunar eclipses. So that's something that can be measured. You can look back historically when they happen. You can project in the future because it's something that is empirical in terms of the way that they like to do knowledge, right? But then there's another aspect which is much more cultural. And that is the way that calendars are constructed in our societies. So I'm right here in Mayan land, and the Mayan calendar continues to this day to have a lot of relevance to many, many people.
Is that true, Andres? Do you follow that debate among anthropologists around the Mayan calendar? Because I'm not like really up on it, but I understood last I heard there was some question about whether it was a calendar or whether it was measuring all sorts of other things, or I don't know what it sounded like there was a lot of different interpretations for what the calendar is exactly.
You're pointing to the very big picture that, you know, said the culmination of the 13th Baktun was going to be in 2012. And then there's a guy who basically said, oh, no, but if you that was calculated under the Julian calendar. But if you look at the calendar we use today, which is the Gregorian, it really points to today. So but anyway, that's the large picture of the Mayan calendar, which there can be debates about. But in terms of there's a 20-day calendar in Mayan culture that really does speak to people on a daily basis. So so yes, it does. There is validity because it really has meaning to folks in today's world. So yes, mm-hmm. it's like the Jewish calendar or the Chinese calendar. These lunar calendars have a significance in those cultures a lot more than in the Western society, which first used the Julian for many millennia. And then since about 500 years ago, we've had the Augustan calendar, right? Which took into account the leap year factor, that it's not exactly, you know, it's 365 days and a quarter. Therefore, you had to have a leap year every 4 years. Anyway, so what I'm working with is something fascinating, which looks at these total lunar eclipses, which are also known as blood moons, right? Because the color of the moon turns bloodish red. And then sort of the intersection of those total lunar eclipses, those blood moons, with a cultural calendrical reality, which is something we call today a blue moon. Okay, mm-hmm. What is a blue moon? It is something that scientists don't care about. Why? Because the latest definition is basically the second full moon in one calendar month. No, you know, oh well, it happens every 2.5 years or so, whatever. So, but it's a calendrical reality. But what my characters in the story discover, because one is a scientist who's really into the total lunar eclipses, and then another is she's a historian of empires, and she's a radical activist, and she happened to be born the very hour that the new definition of a blue moon was also born. And so she discovers this in her life. And so she has a connection to a blue moon because she was born at the same time. And her father was born in a year of three blue moons and so forth, which doesn't happen, but almost every 200 years and so forth. So, but the coming together of these two characters reveals an amazing coincidence, you can call it, or it points to something that is pretty interesting. In the last 300 years, what I call these blood blue moons, in other words, they are the times when there is a blue moon and a blood moon at the same time. There have been four in the last 300 years, one of them in 1765, another in 1776, 1844, and 1982. Okay, those are the ones that took place when there was only one blue moon that year, and it also happened to be a blood moon. Okay, Basically, those dates are interestingly point to the revolutions that have pretty much touched most everybody on the planet in terms of the technological revolution and the industrial revolution. If you look at, you're familiar with history. If you look at the commencement of the Industrial Revolution, I'm told that it began in the 1760s and an 80-year period and ended in the 1840s. So there are two blood blue moons that sort of bookmark that period. And then, interestingly enough, there's a blood blue moon related to the largest empire militarily, economically, that's ever been on the planet, and its connection to the theme of revolution. What am I talking about? I'm talking about July 1776, one of the four blue blood moons that took place in the last 300 years. And so to me, it is lunar wisdom pointing to the largest expression of dominance on the planet that has ever happened, and its inception, but also its culmination, its ending. And so in the novel, it's about looking at these two revolutions. I mentioned the technological revolution. No one agrees when it actually began, but symbolically, Time magazine in December of 1982 put out the machine of the year instead of the man or woman of the year, or person of the year. I think it was still man of the year at that time. But they didn't choose a person, they chose the machine, and it was the computer in December of 1982. And it happened to be the month of a blue blood moon, which points to, in an incredible way, to the technological informational revolution that we're living in. Okay,
yeah, basically— for a great plot line, yeah. Anyway, for a novel, well, regardless of the relationship with the world and history and moon cycles and stuff like that. It's a fantastic fiction plot.
So I'll encourage folks to read it, but there's one other revolution, which is the agricultural, which goes back thousands and thousands of years. And there's also a connection there to these blue blood moons. So folks will have to wait to read about that. But basically, this is what's fascinating, David. We are now living in a metonic cycle, which is a 19-year lunar, earth, solar cycle.
That's called a metonic?
Metonic. It was discovered by this guy named Meton 2,000 years ago. And it's a 19-year cycle that scientists are very clear about, right? And we are currently in one that has not occurred for thousands and thousands of years right now.
When did it start?
It started 2 years ago. And that year we had the longest lunation of the century, meaning the longest lunar period of it ranges. It's not exactly 29 and a half days. It can increase or decrease. But also there was the longest lunar eclipse took place that year in 2018. But it was also the beginning of this metonic cycle, which is 19 years, which culminates in 2037. And there has not been a period like this in thousands of years. And
I'm ready to join your 2037 millenarian cult. I'll sign up, be your first member.
Right. So now I want to ask you something, David, because really what these two characters in the story discover is this amazing pattern, and it goes back to the agricultural revolution when what happened. It's beautiful things happened because we started to have food planted and so forth, but it also was the invention pretty much of private property and the need to protect, to hoard food and protect it and have armies and nations and so forth, right? So The agricultural revolution was really the beginning of this, what's ended up to be our rape of the planet right now, that we're seeing that we're in a sixth mass extinction of species and global climate chaos is out of control. Anyway, what I want to ask you is, I as I listen to many of the folks you've interviewed and many of the people that we hang out with, most of us are very concerned, and you know, we bring together issues of racial, gender justice, our struggle against capitalism and so forth. But what is one term that can really bring together all of these struggles that we need to put an end to? And I'm wondering if you've thought about that or if you're going to write a song about it if you haven't already.
One term that puts an end to all these, all the suffering and liberation, huh? I mean, that's been well used for quite a while now.
Yes. Yeah, liberation speaks to it, but it's also a little vague, right? Because how is liberation related to the anthropocentrical reality that we are all a part of, causing pollution on the planet? I mean, you and I are still addicted to plastic, right? So we are still culprits. We're not as bad as the Pentagon, which is the worst culprit, of course, and they're really raping the earth, but you and I are still complicit. So liberation, yes, we should liberate ourselves from plastic, it's true. But another term has to do with dominance. And when we dominate to the extreme, the largest expression of dominance, I say, is empire itself. So empire is an important word. However, empire is also really generic and it doesn't speak to, you know, the misogyny of patriarchy. When you speak of empire, you don't think of women being raped in the patriarchal world that we live in, right? Or people of color under white supremacy. Okay, so that then led me to think about what is it that we're really dealing with here? We're dealing with supremacism at all of these levels. And that's the word that for me really speaks to what needs to come to an end, because it is what the revolution really has to be about, is ending supremacism in all of its forms. And you know, right now with Black Lives Matter and racial justice being so much fought in the streets, and we are living under the worst economic depression in the United States since 100 years ago, and the pandemic, and all of those things, except for what happened pretty much to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the other day on the steps of the Capitol when she was, called.
Accosted. Yeah.
She was accosted. And then later she said, well, bitches get things done, which is beautiful. I mean, that speaks to the misogyny that continues to be so present. And if we don't really take in the multi-layered aspect of the need for revolutionary change, we really end up not being effective in the change that needs to come. So if we are not alongside of Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg in terms of needing to bring healing to the planet, as well as racial justice, as well as against the patriarchy, as well as bringing down capitalism and all kinds of wealth, war against the needy, or in war against the haves and against the have-nots, if we don't take it on in a coherent, integrated, holistic way, we're ending up, I believe, involved in what could be called, political bypassing. Because this term spiritual bypassing, you may have heard, right? It's like where people say, oh, well, I'm just going to pray about it and things are going to get better and only, you know, stay in the spiritual realm. But it can happen in the political realm too, if we only are focused on our one particular political struggle at the cost of all of these others that need to be dealt with as well. Or, you know, it's not that we need to take them on all the time. We should choose how our gifts particularly ask us to respond to any particular one, but it's so important to have a large picture of the need for real revolutionary change. And I think it's about bringing the end of supremacism in all of its expressions.
I think you've known a lot of people who have been involved with many different aspects of making change, not just, I'm thinking of people like Berta Cáceres, not just an end to empire and not just an end to extractive capitalism, but also an end to male supremacy and all sorts of other things. How did you first meet Berta?
I first met Berta in May of 1997 when an indigenous leader, like she was assassinated. His name was Cándido Amador. He was assassinated April 15th of 1997. And as a result, the indigenous leaders in Honduras of many different peoples decided to come together for the first time, because there had been pilgrimages organized by Copin, which is mostly the Lenca people, but that had taken place in the past. But this was the first time when all of the indigenous peoples came together. We're talking the Miskito, the Pesh, the Tolupan, the Tawaka, the Lenca, all of them together with the Garifuna, basically joining forces to speak against this assassination of Cándido Amador, who was part of the Chorti peoples. And they came to the capital where I lived. I lived in Tegucigalpa, and there was an amazing demonstration there of indigenous rights. they camped out at the presidential palace. He eventually decided to violently evict them. Why? Because he was about to go to Washington, D.C. to get an honorary doctorate degree. We're talking about Carlos Roberto Reyna. He was about to receive an honorary doctorate for what? For his human rights commitment, okay? And here he is kicking, basically militarily, brutally evicting the indigenous from their protests. They didn't go away completely. They just went 2 kilometers down the road, camped out there. He finally sent a negotiating team, and that negotiation led to an accord that was signed that spoke about resolving human rights violations crimes and the need for bilingual education, not just in Spanish, but also in indigenous language. It spoke to housing. And a very big question was the issue of land for the indigenous people. And the president basically ordered his people sign anything. I just want them out of my hair. And he and what was signed was this amazing document, which even speaks to returning land to the indigenous in a way that had never been done before. I was named as a guarantor of that accord by Berta and her husband, and worked for the next couple years on that issue full time, pretty much. I mean, she really changed my life. And she and I were together at a protest on the Mayan ruins in October of 1998, and they had taken over this largest tourist site in the country. And I was traveling with her, and I remember that time because shortly after that is when Hurricane Mitch hit the country. 10,000 Hondurans, among many other Central Americans, were killed, and it completely decimated the country in so many ways, including this process for indigenous rights that had begun as a result of those pilgrimages that Berta had so much been a part of. So an end chapter came with that coming of the hurricane, but it was so powerful to work closely alongside of her and to be influenced by her in such a way that today, as I speak, you even recognize that some of her wisdom is coming out in what I'm trying to put together in this writing that I'm doing.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know where the hour just went, but Andres, do you think there's going to be an election here in the U.S. in November?
I think that Trump is going to refuse to leave power, whether that means he will postpone the election or whether that means that he will completely subvert it in such a way as to gain power by not winning either the popular or the electoral college vote. Something to that degree is going to happen. It's going to blow all of our minds. It's going to involve the worst kind of repression that an empire is involved with, both at the mass level and maybe even assassination level. Who knows? But it's going to be that huge. And this is the deal. If Trump doesn't leave power, it's going to be an invitation to us to respond and to escalate, like we were talking before. We each need to escalate the form of resistance that we are involved with to the empire itself. So that means we need to use our gifts of art and culture and creativity and all kinds of peace action in order to take on the violence of the state. So it'll be a gift in some way that it will invite us to increase our commitment to bring justice on the planet.
Andres, thanks so much for joining me. This has been so interesting and wonderful.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, I'm very, very grateful to you, David, for inviting me and, keep writing songs. And, you know, you're not so well known as a singer-songwriter of love songs, but you know the song that you wrote, Song for My Broken Heart, is one that has always spoken to me, as well as so many of your other songs. So keep at it.
Thank you, Andres.
And
we'll have to talk again on the show because there's a whole lot of stuff I get to ask you about. I have a list of 10 questions. I think I asked 2 of them. But
yeah. We will do that. And I want to end by saying and using a word that they use here with the Kachikel people. And the word is matiosh. And the way I like to translate it is that which is grateful in me recognizes gratitude itself in you.
Oh, nice. Nice. Right back at ya. See you, Andres.
Take care.
Take care. And thanks for tuning in to this conversation with Andres Thomas Contreras. You can find all of these discussions archived in various places, including on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix in the Discussions with David playlist. You'll also find them all in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovix.com. If you want to support my broadcasting efforts, you're most welcome to become a patron at patreon.com/davidrovix, where all of these broadcasts are also available for anyone to download, along with some patron-only offerings as well. If you're in the Portland area, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up to receive text notifications so you can be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response when the investment banks that own half of this city start trying to evict so many of our neighbors. If you want to help make my next album a multi-instrumental success, check out davidrovix.com/pandemic sessions. Remember, don't pay the rent. Don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.